Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today are a pair of guys who know their way around the podcast circuit. Please welcome back to the show the mad geniuses behind the Wrong Reel podcast, Mikhail Karadimov.
Hello.
And Jamie Hancock.
Howdy.
Somber.
If those voices sound familiar, it might be because Mikhail and Jamie have appeared on FlixWise before. Listeners will recall that they joined me to talk about Andrei Tarkovsky on our Stalker episode. But today we have a decidedly different film to discuss. It's the 41st movie on the Sight and Sound list. Satyajit Ray's Rai? Ray? Satyajit Rai?
Are we going pure Bengali pronunciations? If so, then it's Rai.
But Jamie shamed me into calling him Ray months ago, so who knows?
I'm often wrong, but never in doubt.
Yeah. Well, listeners can write in and tell us. I'm sure either way we're doing it wrong. But I'm going to go with Ray.
It's Ray.
Oh, boy. All right. Satyajit Rai, Ray, Ray's Panther Bachali. Plus, for our second topic, we're going to talk about great child actors. Part of what makes Panther Bachali so remarkable is the prominent pre-adolescent players, especially given the conventional wisdom that says youngins don't generally make for great thespians. But surely there are other examples of great performances given by children. We're going to talk about why kids are notoriously difficult to work with. Plus, we're going to talk about some examples that prove that sometimes working with kids doesn't have to be a total disaster. Then we'll peer into the future for some final notes of positivity. And don't worry, I will explain that when we get there. All right, guys.
The future holds nothing but darkness.
You got the wrong guy, yeah, if you want positivity.
Oh, boy.
We're the East Coast.
It is a pit of despair from which nothing emerges.
You know, West Coast vibes, right?
Yeah, huh? And everything here is fast-paced.
Positive vibrations. Yeah. Hey, I lived in L.A. 7 years. I can get myself back in that.
Listen, I spent two days in L.A. I know everything there is to know about it. You're in good, capable hands.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure. All right. Okay, well, all aboard?
We're in.
Let's do it. Okay.
Yes.
Let's talk Panchali.
Carriage return.
Our first topic is Satyajit Rai's 1955 debut feature, Panther Bachali. Ray, inspired by the original Panther Bachali text written by Bibhuti Bhushan?
Yeah.
Bandai Paideya?
It rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it?
I'm so sorry. I apologize to our listeners. I apologize to...
No worries, he's dead.
This gentleman. And I apologize to the citizens of India. That was a complete
And we apologize
disaster.
To all the unborn children of the future who will be outraged by things that we're not even aware are outrageous as we say them.
Yeah, there we go.
Exactly. No, I'm well aware that was a total disaster. I apologize. But I don't think it's going to get any better than that. And so Ray, inspired by the original text, plus the Italian neorealist cinema of Roberto Rossellini and Vittorio De Sica, set out to make his own depiction of a family beset by extreme economic strife. Ray's tale is set in his home state of West Bengal, India. The story begins as the Roy clan welcomes a new baby boy named Apu into the world. The father, Harihar Roy, has recently bartered their orchard holdings in order to pay off old family debts, leaving his household without a reliable means of income or sustenance. While Harihar seems generally unfazed by his current financial instability, his wife, Sarbaijaya, is decidedly less blasé about the whole destitution thing. In fact, she's visibly agitated throughout the course of the movie. Unable to be proactive about the family's money problems, she takes her frustration out on her eldest daughter, Durga, and an elderly relative, Indira Thakran. Yeah, did you? I wasn't sure if it was a great aunt or what. I thought she was just like a neighborhood shift.
Like she just went from house to house, wherever they have her at the moment. But I think she's probably relative.
A great aunt, a grandmother. I mean, she definitely seems to be an elder related by blood. I mean, it's not that large of a village.
But then she would go to other people's homes and they would readily take her in. Although I think they would push her out also if they were like frustrated with her. I mean, she's abrasive, to say the least.
Yeah, and one guy was like, a couple days, that's it. Yeah. But
I've never seen skin stretch so far back into the mouth, you know?
Give like me a little time.
No lips, no nothing.
Just... I plan to be an absolute ogre for the time I reach my twilight age, so.
No, cool.
Well, one of his fears, I think, was because they shot it over the course of like 4 or 5 years. He was always looking for funding for the movie.
She might expire.
She might expire during the entire shoot, and somehow, miraculously, that woman kept on trucking along.
She made it. She made it.
Yeah.
So the majority of the film is made up of familiar domestic scenes. We watch as the children, Apu and Durga, grow into adolescence and form a tight-knit bond that keeps them together, even as their mother's punishments harshen and the family's financial situation grows more and more dire. Pather Panchali is the first film in Rai's Apu trilogy. The life of the Roy son continues in two sequels, Aparajitu, meaning The Unvanquished, was released in 1956, and Apur Sansar, The World of Apu, was released in 1959. But Panchali remains Ray's most enduring and most widely seen film. It currently stands at the 41st spot on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. But what makes Pather Panchali such a timeless classic, and will it continue rising in our cultural pantheon? We shall discuss. Do you like this movie?
Well, I'll go first. I'll just say, for me, just as a viewer, and this is more a personality flaw as opposed to a criticism of the film, I tend to avoid naturalism in movies. For me, when I think of cinema, I think of overt visual stylizations. I like rapid-fire cutting. I like directors who really play the instrument of cinema with like as much virtuosity as humanly possible. So when I see films like Umberto D or Bicycle Thief by Vittorio De Sica, or I see Rome Open City by Rossellini, I really, really love and admire learning about these chapters in film history. But when it comes to what type of food I want to have for dinner, it's not what I reach for first. I tend to like guys like Wells or Lang or these guys that have like much more provocative visual styles as well as content. So for me, I need lots and lots of sex and violence and humor and just raw emotion. I want a lot of insanity. And I feel like people who enjoy kind of lyrical, poetic, you know, just kind of beautiful, heartfelt films where you really get to know the characters, but there's not necessarily a plot driving it forward. There is a huge, huge market for people who love this kind of movies. And I feel like Jean Renoir kind of evolved into one of those directors over time. And I feel like it's worth noting that Satyajit Ray, one of his earliest gigs in the film industry, was, I think, as a location scout, perhaps, for Jean Renoir in his film The River.
Yeah, The River. Have you seen The River?
I have seen The River. I saw The River in 2000 on VHS, but my memories are dim apart from a little kid being killed by a snake. Spoiler alert.
Yes.
But,
but when it comes to Renoir, to watch it now.
Yeah, I like movies like The Rules of the Game or A Day in the Country. Those are my kind of Renoir movies, like, you know, Le Chien, like the, you know, his early stuff. So I would say any criticism I have towards Pather Panchali comes from the fact that I'm just not the natural audience for this kind of
Real
flick.
Quickly, uncredited assistant director on the movie.
Okay,
yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
But, okay. But I know he did scout locations, so.
Well, I'm sure, yeah, he had to do a lot of stuff for them. Like, yeah. And but, I mean, he was the reason why he ended up, Jean Renoir was the reason why he ended up trying to make movies. So, I mean, for that, I really do like this movie so much so that I was having a day off when I watched the first one, and then I, in consecutive order, ended up watching the second and third one, too. And I actually felt, by the end of the trilogy, that I felt the same way I felt when I was watching Boyhood. You know, just the grand sweep of it. And I don't know if it's something that, like, if I watch them one at a time with 2-3 weeks in between or months or whatever, I would feel the same or not feel the same. But I know every time I watch the third one, that same sweeping emotion comes in because you have, in a way, seen this guy grow up.
And quadruple feature. Program that bitch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To watch the Apu trilogy, followed by Boyhood. All in one fell swoop.
Yeah, I want to know. The ticket sales would be dismal for that, probably.
Be an army of one.
But, I mean, to get to your point, though, I mean, I think it is a stylized movie in that it's just like, it's still,
well, he has,
you know,
moments where he does have some really cool cinematic stylistic flourishes that I really, really loved. The introduction of Apu, when his sister's trying to wake him up and she's kind of like prying his eye open,
and his eye kind of snaps alert and looks at her right as the Ravi Shankar score kind of kicks into high gear. And I was like, whoa, I was like, that was fucking awesome. And I really responded to it. And then later on in the movie, when the husband comes home after doing God knows what for 5 or 6 months about finding himself, and the wife is about to start just wailing with sorrow over the death of her daughter, Durka, Durka, Durka. instead of hearing her cry, you hear the score, which I thought was astonishingly cool. Mm-hmm. But just it was a film where I was periodically checking to see how much remained in the running time. And so I won't be rushing out to see The Unvanquished.
Yeah. Well, The Unvanquished is my least favorite in the trilogy. But how do you feel about the movie?
Well, I think everything, Jamie, that you just described about the movie is almost all true, except I would argue that this has it is a very stylish film. Roy was a graphic designer before he became a filmmaker, and I think that really comes through. But that whole lyrical, elegiac, meditative style of filmmaking is just like right up my alley.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I look for in movies. So the reasons that you might steer clear of it are the exact reasons why I am really drawn to it. So it's just a matter of personal taste.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think I was watching it on a rainy day too. So there was just a rhythm between what was going on outside and what was going on the screen that it just kind of matched up for me in a very, we've had many conversations about our different tastes in movies. And yeah, I think it's just to each their own with this flick. And if you can't get into it, I totally understand it. I don't think I would ever go to the mats with anyone for disliking this movie and having the same exact reasons.
Not an active dislike, but it's kind of like when we had our Wim Wenders episode and I was almost frustrated by the fact that I couldn't find a way to kind of surrender over to his movies. And, I'll never attack Wim Wenders.
But I think to a certain extent, this movie, Pather Panchali and all his other movies, there is a certain intellectualism to it that keeps you out of guard, just like Wim Wenders. Although I think Wim Wenders is that to the nth degree. You can never really penetrate a Wim Wenders movie because he's also got that German thing going where it's just, there really is a lack of emotion unless it's monumental like Herzog. And so, that's my question to both of you guys. Do you think, does the emotion in this film resonate, or is it more of an intellectual practice? And is that what's actually, kind of pleasing us about the movie?
Well, I know some people did criticize Satyajit Ray for, he's from the aristocracy, he was educated in the West, and some found it to be almost like an intellectual pretension that he was making a movie about a world that he clearly did not come from. My defense of Rai would be, it's based on a book, and so it's like, it's not like he was like, oh, I'm going to make this movie about this little petri dish of poor people. He found a book he responded to, and he wanted to film it. So I don't think that criticism of him is totally valid.
Well, but there is the added idea, like, he actually did inject, apparently, a lot of himself into the movie, too, so he kind of reworked the novel around so that it was a bit of an autobiographical tale, too, as he said in many interviews, like, in the future. So would that change your opinion on that, now that you could see that maybe he's trying to draw a parallel between these people and his lifestyle?
I mean, it's like Anton Chekhov writing plays about, living in the country prior to the Russian Revolution and everything. Like, I feel like no matter how sophisticated an artist might be, there's nothing wrong with tackling simple people living in simple conditions. And I feel like he finds some sort of universal truth through the characters' emotions and their experiences.
Well, there's like a fine line to it, whereas you're taking a picture of an old person because you think it's quaint and you think that's what's easily marketable and everyone will take it for that. And then there's the other flip of the coin where you actually are interested in these people. Like, which one is it? Because that's the thing I've questioned myself.
I'm not interested in nagging housewives, and for the first 20 minutes of the movie, it was nothing but girls bitching at each other, and I was like, I'm going to kill myself watching this movie. I can't handle 1 second more of these girls just giving each other shit over stealing fruit and borrowing money. And
you are killing me.
When the kid got introduced, I was like, all right, well, now I've got this little boy that I can kind of like sink my hooks into and kind of like tackle the world or enter the world through his vantage point. And I really, really love the character of Apu. I think he's a fantastic little character. I love and adore him.
Yeah.
But the mundane concerns of domesticity is probably why at age 39, not only am I not married, I don't even have a girlfriend. The mundane concerns of domesticity bore me to the point of aggression.
So was this like more of a horror movie for you? You're just like, no!
every time Apu's mother was lecturing anybody about anything, the only time I really felt real emotion, like where I sympathized with her, is when she said, don't you think I have my own dreams? And you could tell she didn't always want to be the girl having to count every penny or every ruble and kind of like
crack the whip. That's not the lot in life she wanted. Right. But the reality is, for the majority of the 2-hour running time, it's just her giving people shit. And after a while, I couldn't handle her anymore.
But I did want to say something regarding whether it was appropriate for Wright to depict people outside of his social circle or his cast or whatever. The film doesn't feel condescending in any way.
No.
It's very respectful of these people. It's
he loves
a humanist film. Yeah, he loves all of them. And it's not like, look at how poor they are. It doesn't feel like poverty porn. Mm. And then regarding your point about how it's a bunch of women bitching at each other. I mean, it's true, but it's also a part of life. And that scene felt very familiar to me. I mean, that's part of being a human, and we are social creatures and we live within these social confines. And I understood immediately why she would be upset, given not only does she have money issues, she has neighbors and distant relatives nagging her to pay her back and bought, like,
and just so I don't come across like a complete misogynist, I had just as much disdain for her loser husband who had all these dreams about, oh, I'm gonna be a poet and philosopher and a writer and all this kind of, and, like, you know, meanwhile, like, his stories were being eaten by parasites in his home and everything. But this is a guy who has 2 kids and is clearly not providing for him and has all these schemes and ambitions. But I guess it reminds me of that line where Billy Wilder once said, too much reality is not what the people want. Like, when I see a movie that depicts very real everyday concerns that are very relatable and they're very acute financial, emotional, and familial concerns that everyone experiences, it's not what I go to see movies for. It's kind of like I can walk out on the street and I can see people in abject poverty asking me for cash. And I'm like, oh, there's human suffering right there. When I go see a movie, I want to be transported. I want Children of Paradise. I want Lawrence of Arabia. I want Citizen Kane. I want to be taken into a fantastic world that's totally other than the mundane real world.
So I take it you're not an Ozu fan.
Strangely enough, I loved Good Morning. I thought it was hysterical. And I enjoyed Tokyo Story.
Doesn't make sense, but who knows?
Maybe I'm just a sucker for Japanese culture, but yeah. I've only seen 2 Ozu, but I enjoyed both of them. So.
Okay, interesting. Because this movie reminded me a lot of Ozu. I know Rai cites the Italian neorealism as his main influence, but it immediately struck me that it was a lot like Tokyo Story, in that you notice it's sort of this episodic structure, and each episode is delineated by these pillow shots, as they call them, of, you know, wind blowing between leaves and raindrops falling. And
those are some of my favorite moments of the film, though. Those are all the footage of, like, the insects kind of, like, skirting across the surface of the water. That stuff I found absolutely riveting. I really enjoyed those sequences.
Yeah.
You see, I'm going to say something. Don't like Tokyo Story. Don't like it.
Whoa.
Had nothing for it. Don't care that you're shooting the whole movie flat, buddy. Does nothing for me. I don't care if you're looking just off the center of the lens. You're not doing anything to me.
Wow.
I don't know, because that one I felt like was way too fixed in what I saw. And maybe, you know, it's dated, or maybe that's how it actually was, but it felt very trapped in, like, stereotypes of how we think of Japanese people now, to a certain extent of, like, you know, just, I don't know. I can't really explain it without seeming offensive, I guess.
How come you hate Japanese people?
Yeah, I mean, like, that's, I guess,
you never
told
me this.
I'm really working this out right now. This is, now that Jamie's kind of, like, verbalized it for me. But,
all right, well, we have Jamie with his exoticism, and then Mikhail with his just racism. Well, you guys are going great.
First of all, exoticism sounds a lot better. The man admitted to being a misogynist earlier in the episode.
I think I just hate people. I admit it, I hate
you're a misanthrope.
Exactly.
All right. But, you know, Satyajit Rai, at least he's moving the camera. I thought his photography is a lot more exhilarating. That scene out in the fields where they're just watching the train go by, it's so much more cinematic to me. Like, that, at no point am I watching Tokyo Story while checking my watch and thinking, oh, I really wish I could bore myself on a big screen with this movie. You know, Satyajit Rai, I did. I wanted to see that on the big screen. I saw it at home. I saw all 3 movies at home. It was playing the film form. Then I ran to the film form and then caught as many as I could in theaters. So, I mean, I really love these movies.
Now, had Ravi Shankar done any film scores prior to this film?
No.
I love
this first score.
I know. It's fantastic.
Well, his first score, Satyajit Rai's first time making a movie, and the DP's first time picking up a camera. Like, all autodidacts. None of them knew how to...
That's right, autodidacts.
None of them knew what they were doing, really, you know, to a full extent. And also, they... I mean, just think about that. For 5 or 6 years or however many years, they had to, like, cobble money together, take huge amounts of time off, and still, it's a consistent film. It's a consistent film all the way through, and there's a through line. Yeah. And,
well, let's get into the production process a little bit, because I think it is remarkable that it is... not only coherent, but basically you cannot tell that this was filmed over a series over the course of 3 years.
Except for Apu's definitely aging. You know, there are scenes where he seems like borderline a toddler, and then all of a sudden he's starting to look more like a just a baby-faced youth.
But so
I didn't notice.
I read a brief biography of him in the Biographical Dictionary film by David Thompson, just to kind of get an overview of his career, but I have not read up on the actual filming itself.
It was apparently filmed over the course of 3 years, and the issue was that they were trying to find funding, and Ray would refuse money if the financial backer wanted any input on the script or wanted any kind of sort of approval of the film. So what's remarkable, not only was he a first-time director, but he really stuck to his guns on this.
Quick question on this front. When I studied Italian neorealism in college, what I was taught, now I've only seen a handful of neorealist films, it seemed like those were shot with non-professional actors on cheap locations, mostly out of necessity. Due to a completely collapsed Italian economy and film industry post-World War II, when Satyajit Ray set about making kind of something in the same spirit, was he at that point looking at neorealism as a style as opposed to a necessity? Or did he have a similar situation where he couldn't afford actors and he couldn't afford real locations, so neorealism was an easy kind of avenue through which to make the flick?
I'm not positive, but I know that he has said disparaging things about the Indian film industry.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think he wanted something that would be more of an artistic expression as opposed to a piece of overproduced entertainment for the masses.
Well, the other thing was he also would be like Bengali specific films, so he would only have like a swath of the population. It wasn't all of India watching his movies, because Bengali, it was like a very specific region, specific language,
Western Europe that really likes his movies the most.
Far as like domestic interest in his films went, he still had like a very, very small part of the pie.
Yeah, when I was in business school, there were 35 kids from India in my class, and I was running this like film club where I'd show once a week a foreign film. And when it was time to do India, I asked for their input, and I said, "Hey guys, I've always wanted to learn about Satyajit Ray. Why don't we show one of his movies?" And they're like, "Oh, he's not even Indian." And I was like, "What are you talking about? He's from India. He made movies in India." Like, these weren't cinephiles. These weren't film lovers. They just loved good old fashioned mainstream Indian musicals and that sort of thing. But for them, for their palate, he was very, very atypical for the Indian film industry. Mm-hmm. And we ended up watching instead a 4.5-hour musical called Sholay, which is basically like watching Armageddon but with music, and it's, you know, it's spies and it's chases and it's all this crazy shit, but it's love songs and it's suicides. It's just pure melodrama from start to finish, and it's 4.5 hours basically of nothing but songs. And, you know, it was like basically being force-fed cotton candy for 4.5 hours, but they just were in tears and they loved it. And they were like, "Oh, it's our Citizen Kane, we absolutely love it," and blah 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 blah. But it's interesting to see it. I wonder to what percentage of kind of academia or hardcore cinephiles or critics loved Satyajit Ray in his own country versus, because our Western perspective, he's loved as a god. I mean, you have guys like Scorsese who just bow before the altar of Satyajit Ray. So
yeah, Kurosawa has the same thing, the same like charge leveled at him all the time. Is like these aren't Japanese movies; these are very Western movies. I mean, a lot of them are also kind of just modeled off of John Ford flicks, also to a certain extent. So, I mean, that's what happens though when international film becomes a thing. You just, everyone's kind of cross pollinating, and you're just going to borrow from other nationalities. And this very, very much goes against my usual argument though of like, I really do like the idea of national identities in film, because it would create different styles instead of a hodgepodge. That
you're a man of interesting contradictions.
I am a man of very and you know, fuck global. Oh, heyo, I apologize. But you know, bleep globalization, because I, to a certain extent, I do. I don't know. I miss. I don't know. I really do sound like a colonialist, but like borders. I really do like distinct and, you know, defined borders. But there's something to be said that you find out different things from different people in different walks of life. And I think that's slowly just kind of evaporating.
Like the nicer way of saying this, you like a rich, diverse cultural tapestry of different forms of filmmaking. You don't want it all to get melted into the same kind of glop.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. But yeah, I didn't mean Ray, I've been saying Ray and Rye. I've been like switching back and forth, like sometimes in the same sentence.
People can make a drinking game out of it.
Billy
it's fine.
Ray, Capricorn.
Yeah.
Any Trading Places fans?
But actually, funnily enough, one of the influences he cites is Ernst Lubitsch.
Interesting.
Really?
We talked about on your podcast not too long ago.
Speaking of cross-pollination.
How about that?
Any film in particular that he mentioned that he really responded to?
Trouble in Paradise. It was one of the first... It was his introduction to sound films.
I will say this, though, about Ray. From what I can gather, his movies do get lighter as he goes along. So,
gotcha. All right.
Maybe the Lubitsch starts to play a factor in then later.
Well, do you think that Panchali is overly dour?
I didn't find it to be that way. I felt like it earned every depressing beat. I just, I enjoy narrative, and this movie was more atmospheric.
Yeah.
And, but I felt like, you know, the scene where Durga passes away, it is very, very moving. So,
yeah. And especially as you mentioned, the scene where the mother has to tell the father.
That's my favorite.
So
that's
harrowing.
My favorite scene of the whole film, hands down.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an amazing feat when you can make a movie where not much happens and it's harrowing.
Yeah, no, it reminded me a lot of Umberto D. Umberto D has one kind of big cinematic moment. And the whole movie is just this old man looking around for his dog, and it's very slow and it's very plodding and just, wow, we're going to literally just watch this sad old man for an hour and a half look for his best friend. And at the very end, he's about to commit suicide, and he has this bit where a train rushes by, and it's like, whoa! And it's like, the movie gets incredibly cinematic and explosive for those few seconds. And so it's kind of like a punctuation, and I feel like Satyajit Ray is doing a similar thing with this.
Yeah, and the train motif is in this as well, and I wonder what you guys thought that was doing in there. What does it symbolize?
Take it away, Mr. Karadima.
Yeah.
You know, a subtler mind for this question.
No, I think it's a fairly kind of rudimentary metaphor, but whatever. It's just the idea of, like, I don't know, if you watch the entire... Have you seen the entire trilogy?
I have, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, it's the idea of, like, he really does want to westernize himself to a certain extent, you know, and the train has always been an old motif for westernization, industry, moving forward, just forging ahead, and that's very much, I don't know, I think they try to wonder what's ahead of them when they see, like, something like that barrel through their town, like, what more is there to this entire world, because they live awfully provincial lives, and it's about how to find a larger scope, a larger meaning, and, yeah, and just, I think he has trains in all three movies, and just this idea of departures and exits and how people are constantly saying farewell to him and his life, and they just kind of verge off into different directions, i.e. death. They die. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's just all those things, how life just keeps going. You can't stop it. You either jump on or you jump off, or you get smacked over the head by it. You just get flattened, I suppose, like a penny.
Yeah. That's been, very rudimentary.
And that's been morose metaphors of Mikhail Karadimov.
People hop on, they hop off.
Or they're flying.
Such
like
is life. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing, really.
And Mikhail, he comes from a train-going culture from the moment.
Anna Karenina, that's how she ends her life with a train. That's cinema. That's cinema.
Spoiler.
That's cinema, Jamie. That's cinema.
I like cinema.
Cinema. But yeah, that's my reading on that. I'm sure there's other stuff he's always had a fascination for trains. It also might just be a bit of a fetish for him.
So the scene where the kids are running towards the train track, you know, speaking of your favorite, Mr. Anderson, it kind of reminded me of that scene in The Master. Where Joaquin Phoenix's character is getting chased through the field.
If you invoke the Master,
after...
you're opening a
You're starting
can of worms.
A different podcast right now.
Uh-oh.
This is a different
episode.
Oh,
dear.
Now
okay.
Yeah, Mikhail might try to assert
control. But it reminded me of that. That's what I thought of.
Wait,
maybe
but which
just because I knew
which scene in the Master?
The scene where Joaquin Phoenix accidentally poisons the dude.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and he's running
away.
Oh,
God. The color in those shots. just the greens and the blues and how they come out. They're super saturated. And, yeah, it's shot in 70 millimeter. I can't control myself. Anyway.
Oh, no. What have I done?
No, we'll move on. Move on. Just roll. Okay. You got to run past it.
Just keep going with it. Yeah. So, but anything else that, any other visual stylistic things that struck you in this movie?
I mean, on that note, it's worth mentioning, like, how Criterion jumped through amazing hoops. Ooh, this cursing thing. Amazing hoops to really, like, find and restore this film. Because before this, I mean, the version I watched was a scratched up, like, when I originally saw it, a scratched up, terrible print. And it wasn't, like, from the original negatives or anything. The original negatives, apparently, in what, I don't know if you know, but in 91, 92, around thereabouts, a library in London burned down, and the original went with it. But I know a company bought up all the prints. They took it over to Italy. There are these restorers in Italy that work specifically with celluloid, and they hydrated the film with, like, special solution to give it, like, that moisture again. And then Criterion went through the digital restoration of it. And so this was a labor of love, man.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, the restoration, I finally seen a copy of it. It is beautiful. Like, you have no clue how much they fixed up. Like, there were parts of this film that were charred up, and you could see the burn marks and the little, like, dry areas that look like dried mud and how it just comes off the ground. It's incredible what they did with it, and it took them about 13 days to, like, hydrate the whole thing, and that's, like, way longer. Usually a movie takes about, surprisingly, 4 days to restore, and this one took 13 or something.
Yeah. Labor. I mean, it is remarkable when you think about it. The negative was essentially just a mound of ash.
Yeah.
And they were able to fix it. That's amazing. And I think we're all very, very grateful that Criterion
Jamie
the
more than
put
anyone
in
else, I think.
I know. But okay.
Even
I
films
think
that I don't plan on watching repeatedly, I do love nothing more than film preservation. So the fact that, like, 80% of all silent films are lost forever, and who knows how many sound films, but film shrinks and contracts over time, and it is a finite material. And
it used to be made up of the most combustible
material that we have as many films as we do, considering the materials that they are preserved on. So yeah, I feel like every time you save a film from destruction, that is a cause for celebration.
Absolutely, yeah. I feel like you guys probably have this argument a lot on your podcast, so I don't want to dwell on it too much. But I do feel like, Jamie, as a film lover, I really do want to convince you that this is cinematic.
I mean, it is a movie, so I guess technically it's really cinematic. For me, cinematic is definitely more of a kind of a show-off-y kind
violence
of style.
Sexy.
I need something a little more visceral. I guess also as I get older, I like things that shock me out of my complacency. I don't really like meditative type of stories. I want films that are going to horrify me or arouse me or, like, you know, just kind of like an electric shock to the brain. I want to be electrified.
So from now on, whenever we're gonna go watch a plotless movie, I'll just take a taser with me.
Exactly.
And I'll just keep you excited the entire time.
Just puts, like, some electrical nodes into the seat that just kind of give me, like, a little hum throughout the whole flick.
This movie's amazing.
And then you'll appreciate the movie.
Got lightning bolts coming out of my fingertips. I love it.
I mean, because I do listen to you guys. This all sounds very familiar to me, but I have to say, it's, like, it's frustrating.
Well, I guess, right? When I think of the 50s, the guys are really, like, you know, be like Jean-Pierre Melville, Samuel Fuller, but there's, like, certain common themes that kind of pop up with a lot of these guys, and, like, crime appears in a lot of them, or, like, you know, Anthony Mann westerns and things like that. But, you know, even, like, Ingmar Bergman, who is obviously one of the great film artists, there is so much violence and horror and sex appeal and humor in his films. I find them to be extraordinarily cinematic, and the photography, whether it's Gunnar Fischer or Sven Nykvist, it is, like, one of the most, it's like, it's a virtuoso performance of what you can do with photography, and so I find every frame to be a little miniature masterpiece. So I don't know what the disconnect is for me with Satyajit Ray, but I'm not, like I said, I don't want to overtly criticize him, because also I've seen one movie one time. I don't know shit about this director. When I've seen 5, 6, 7, 8 of his films, a few multiple times, then I'll be qualified to give an opinion on him. You know, someone like Bergman, I've seen over 20 of his movies, many of them several times over, and so
his movies are terrifying.
Which I love.
That's a whole other podcast. But yeah, but I think were you the one who was talking about whether like this idea that realism as a style more than
just didn't interest me.
Yeah, but like cinema verite, that is a style. That is, and in itself, it is cinematic. It is an affectation.
Yeah, like D.A. Pennebaker, his documentary about Bob Dylan, "Don't Look Now" or "Don't Look Back," it absolutely is that cinema verite style. But I'm getting to watch Bob Dylan play his guitar and that sort of thing, so I get totally sucked in. So I feel like it has its place. And
did you really want to see any of these people having sex in this movie?
No.
Like, I don't want to see any of these people getting down
but
dirty.
That's a problem. Movies should have people that I want to have sex with.
Not every movie.
Well, movies that I watch. Like, this
yeah,
is like,
I know.
Trouble in Paradise. Beautiful women. I love this girl.
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't like Ninotchka, that first one. That Ninotchka? First one was a nag.
Beautiful women.
No.
I don't know.
All right. I mean,
Ingmar Bergman. Beautiful women.
I can't help but like always feel like the older prude in these conversations, like, yeah, Jamie, you don't need sex.
I'm emotionally immature, to put it kindly. If you wanted to be more aggressive than that, I would accept that as well.
No, I mean, I get it. I certainly get it. And I can't watch these movies, like, ad nauseum one after the other. I watched this trilogy, that was good, and then I took 2 months off and watched this next movie. This isn't like Tarantino. I'm not going to go through the entire filmography. This isn't Bergman, who, like you said, there is very much a visceral reaction to it. This you have to contemplate. This you have to sit and think. And sometimes I just like that movie. Sometimes I like to sit down and put a jigsaw puzzle together and just kind of think about something. Mm-hmm. And this movie affords me that. I don't have to listen to the dialogue necessarily. I know that might be blasphemous. I just get to kind of like riff with the movie. Talk philosophy with the movie. It's
Does
like a
it
dialogue.
Count that the movie inspired me to eat a nice healthy plate of vegetarian vegetable korma from an Indian restaurant?
Yeah,
after
I think that was a big step
in the
right direction.
If only
the
people in the movie had access to that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so one thing, like I said, I don't make too much out of my initial kind of tepid or lukewarm response to the movie, because with challenging filmmakers, and we talked about this a bit with the Tarkovsky episode of A Stalker, there are some directors who make you sit up and come to them and have your shot of espresso, and you got to, like, Antonioni. Antonioni is not going to, well, I guess some of his later movies do, but his films in the late 50s, early 60s, you need to sit up and you need to focus on the fucking thing if you're going to be able to make heads or tails of it, and he's not going to do the work for you. And this is, for me, one of those movies where I have to, they come to me 50% and I have to go the rest of the way to the film.
Well, you see, and that's the mm-hmm. thing, though. Like, you don't the thing that I like about those filmmakers is that you don't have to like every one of them. That's the point of what they're doing, is that it's not going to touch everyone. It's not going to speak to everyone. There's a lot of filmmakers, I'm sure, that you really adore that I'm like, I can't make the trip to them either.
All right. Well, if it's not your bag, that's cool. That is cool. I'll accept that. Kind of. I mean, obviously, I think less of you now than I did when we first started, but
Uh-oh.
That
well,
was
we
inevitable.
Well, when we saw Stalker, I said it was one of the best movies I'd ever seen, so that,
yeah.
That's the truth.
That is true. Yeah, Stalker
that's
is the
true.
Shit. I fucking love Stalker. Nope.
You can't win them all.
You cussed 3 times on this episode. I only got one.
All right, well.
Am I winning or am I losing?
I hate to bring it to you.
Yeah.
I love that this is you guys not cussing.
No, this is us not realizing that we're cussing.
Josephine Brown doesn't cuss like this, and he comes on your episode and he's like, man, Orson Welles is the fucking shit. I'm quoting Josephine Brown. He's a great historian.
Okay, fine.
Okay,
right.
Well, let's talk about the Sight and Sound list before we get completely out of hand.
Yeah.
It is the 41st movie on the Sight and Sound critics poll. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, Jamie, you don't think it should be, maybe you don't think it should be there, or...
Well, I guess the list is a poll of critics. So if they say they love the movie, then it absolutely deserves to be in 41st place. It's like a mathematical certainty. But if I were to create my top 250 movies, this would not be on it. I could think of 250 movies that I would place ahead of it. But if shitloads of great critics love and adore this movie, then it very much deserves its place at 41.
Yeah.
And it's inspired so many great filmmakers. So once again, it's a personality flaw on my part that I didn't somehow see for what it is. When directors that I love say they love it, then clearly there's something there.
That sounds accurate.
Mikhail, how about you? What do you? I think you're a fan of the movie, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've been very flippant this last hour or so, but I haven't showed the due respect that I actually feel for this movie. But I think that has a lot to do in part with, like, I do like to take it as a full trilogy, and so therefore my favorite, you know, entry into the trilogy would be the last movie, and that's where my heart really lies with the film. And I think the performance that the main actor gives in that film is just like something else.
Are all three films in the top 250?
Oh, The World of Apu is on the list.
And that's my favorite one. So
okay.
You see, more of my love lies for that movie more than anything else.
Okay, interesting. That one is in the 235th spot, tied with a whole bunch of other movies.
That sounds like bananas. I have a stronger word for that.
I think the first one is my favorite because it was the most surprising. I honestly went into this thinking it was going to be dull and ponderous, and I came out just absolutely delighted. Not only did I think it was visually stunning, the story I thought was really moving in that it's a depiction of poverty, but it's not... It doesn't revel in the poverty. It doesn't get off on showing you starving people or miserable people. It's primarily focused on two adorable children and their interaction and their bond. And I have a younger brother, so any kind of story about a protective older sister.
Did you kick his ass when he stole your tinfoil?
Pretty much, yeah.
Little
I mean, it was very similar. Like, I was bossy and he... was annoying. So
that's another one of my favorite bits. Also, they see the play, he gets inspired, he makes the little tiara, and she has to whoop his ass.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And I adore the little girl in the movie, Durga. I thought she was
fantastic,
adorable, and the actress is fantastic. And also another parallel that I wanted to mention between this and Bicycle Thieves. Bicycle Thieves, a little kid in that movie was discovered on the street, and. Same with this one, the little kid who plays Apu, discovered on the street. Whether Ray did that intentionally as an homage to Bicycle Thieves, or whether it was just like a practical matter about like this is the best kid for the job, I don't know. But
I think
it
he like
perfectly.
Regretted casting him actually because he turned out to be like an insufferable little, you know.
Well, we can talk about that in the next chapter of the episode about working with child actors.
Exactly. All right. Well, in case I think that's as good a segue as any. So let's just go ahead and wrap up this topic. 41st spot. I'm going to go ahead and say, yeah, I like 41 for this. The performances in Pather Panchali are great across the board. I feel comfortable saying that anyway.
I would not dispute that.
All right, good. But the naturalism of the child actors is one of its most remarkable features. This clearly flies in the face of W.C. Field's famous quote, never work with animals or children. But the underage performers from Panchali aren't outliers. Cinema history is littered with scene-stealing tykes of all shapes and sizes. So what's with the perceived wisdom that children can't act? We're going to talk about that. Plus, we'll list off some of our favorite central performances given by kids, or just performances given by kids.
I just want to clarify one thing about W.C. Fields. He did revise his statement about children. He said he loves children, particularly girl children, between the ages of 18 and 21. So,
okay. Sounds like a charmer.
Oh, Jamie.
More,
W.C. Fields, ladies and gentlemen. See the bank dick. It kicks ass.
W.C.
That is true. But, okay, so child actors. You guys have thoughts?
I guess, well, your question you sent earlier is what makes for a good child actor. For me, I guess a child actor who is not aware that they're acting nor do they want a career in show business probably are two wonderful qualities for being a great child actor. Because there are children who are trained from birth to be child actors, and they can become little petulant emperors and empresses and just horrible people to be around. But occasionally you get a natural performance, like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. There's a famous little boy, and there's a scene where aliens are in his house, and you're not seeing any alien. You're just seeing the camera on the boy's face. And at one point, he reacts in complete terror. And the way they did it, they didn't ask the kid to act. They set up a clown who walked into the room, was like kind of making him laugh. Then the clown like pulled something up, and behind it was a guy in a gorilla costume. And the kid recoiled in horror from the kid in the gorilla costume. But then the guy with the gorilla costume took the mask off, and the kid started smiling when he recognized the person. And in the movie, it looks like the kid is smiling now at this alien who initially scared him. And it's a wonderful, magical moment. But it was achieved not through the craft of acting, but through a very elaborate ruse that Spielberg had to play to get the performance he wanted.
Child actors are only good when you're able to successfully manipulate them.
What's your favorite child performance?
There's actually an actor that I really like right now who did Tree of Life, Ty Sheridan. He's a pretty good actor. I think he played the oldest son in that film, and then he went on to play the counterpart to Matthew McConaughey's character in Mud. And he's just someone who just, I think he is probably more of a professional actor, and he's not someone that has to be bullied into a great performance, although I'm sure Terrence Malick does his own things to actors. He's very good. Like, you could tell he's technical, but he does always deliver a great performance, and he's been able to age. Now he's like 18, 19, 20, and he's still doing good and steady work. So
when you mentioned it earlier, what do you think of the performance in Boyhood?
It's okay. I don't know if it's a great performance or it's something that you just can't help but be swept up in when you see someone literally growing on the screen. Like, I don't know if he's giving, at the very least, a satisfactory performance, you know, a basic performance. But at the same time, to see someone aged over the course of 12 years, that in itself, that experience is just it resonates way too much to even be clouded by this idea of acting. You know, I don't know if that makes sense.
It totally makes sense. And I think I gave him a lot more leeway as a child actor and less as a teenage actor.
I actually think they just tapped into this idea that he's probably comfortable with Rick Linklater, like 10 years into the process. He's probably comfortable in front of the camera, comfortable with that crew, has grown to think of them as a family. And it's a very naturalistic performance. It's not a performance, though. They're just catching him on 3 days out of his year, and he's playing his life. A lot of that stuff was just culled from his private experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, it's a good performance, but is it a performance? No, this is probably the only thing he's going to be able to do ever with his acting career, is my read on that.
Yeah, so essentially he gave a good performance for a child actor, which is kind of what Jamie was talking about.
Yeah.
Right, like caught him at the right time. That's kind of
like
the key.
It seems like any great child actor, they have one great performance to give in their very first movie, and then they utterly fail to recapture it. I guess unless you are Ron Howard and somehow manage to transition from Andrew Griffith Show into Happy Days into being a director and kind of like, you know, somehow he's like the one child actor who didn't become a heroin addict or like a sex fiend, or it's just he became one of the most, you know, I don't really like his movies, but he became one of the most successful people in Hollywood, and he started as a child actor. The fact that he emerged as this relatively normal, kind of happy, healthy guy is, I think, a minor miracle.
Where are we drawing the line at child actor? What's the age?
That's a good question. Yeah, I would say
prepubescent.
Prepubescent. Yeah. All right, so 12 is probably around when we should stop considering.
I guess it depends
on
when you go through puberty.
At one point in your lives, do you think you could have taken direction?
Ooh.
Me?
Yeah.
Never.
I guess it depends on the director. The director has to have an incredibly deft hand at it, and some are better at it than others. I mean, I saw a movie for the first time earlier this year that totally destroyed me emotionally. Rialto Pictures re-released Forbidden Games at Rene, is it Clement? So I never know how to pronounce his last name, but saw Forbidden Games the first time, and I'm not ashamed to admit, I bawled like a baby through half the movie from these performances from the children. So just so you don't think I'm a hard-hearted man from some of my statements earlier, Forbidden Games destroyed me. I can't even watch the trailer without getting like all glassy-eyed. So for me, those are the two greatest child performances ever, but they seem completely, like, you know, devoid of any sort of like self-consciousness whatsoever. They are, as you know, for a guy who's just trashing naturalism earlier, they feel very naturalistic.
But I think maybe we need to establish like what we look for in a performance in general, and like a performance from an adult versus a kid. Do we have different sets of expectations?
I don't, like, out of every aspect in movies, I probably expect the least from acting. Like, that's the one realm I still, every time I go see a movie, I'm waiting for that one performance to surprise me more than anything else. I think there's nothing more exciting than an actor who surprises me than rather a shot or a composition or a line of dialogue or any other aspect of filmmaking. I think it's when an actor decides to kind of revolutionize a performance that's when I'm really excited about.
Yeah, but I had that same thought today, actually.
Every shot that you see where they revolutionize, there's probably 100 where they tried to revolutionize, and they're like, whoa, what's this actor doing? Like, who told him he's allowed to do that? I always trust the instincts of a good director and a good editor to pick that moment, because you never know how many, like, Klaus Kinski outright, you know, temper tantrums they might have had before getting to that moment that they selected for the movie.
No, but still, I mean, I guess my point, though, is that I don't expect anything from a performance.
Okay.
And so, if the next question is, what do I expect from a child actor, I guess at that point it's just, God, a performance. Like, any performance, I just want a performance. I don't need to have another, like...
Lady P, can you think of a movie that you saw where you were loving the movie, but the child performance was so wretched it took you out of the movie?
I think Shane is kind of the quintessential example of this.
Come
the
back,
kid
Shane!
Who plays Joey. Come back, Shane!
What about Lieber to Heaven? I know that kid for Lieber to Heaven.
Oh, Jesus Christ, man.
Like, oh, okay, I'll warm up in a minute. Like, girl, I'm gonna go swimming with my broken legs. Oh, jeez, I'm dying now.
He's a paraplegic.
What is it? That's why I didn't want to pay attention to his arc.
I'm offended.
So, but to be clear, like, I still think Shane is a great movie, and Joey does not ruin
Which
ruin
one is
it
Shane?
For me.
Shane's a George Stevens Western starring Alan Ladd.
Oh, yes. Did not watch it.
Where they famously dug trenches all around the set so that the other actors wouldn't tower over Alan Ladd, who was a very, very short man.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, but yeah, I think there are numerous examples of instances where annoying children ruin movies. And I think that, like, there's this, we could do like a little taxonomy of the child actor here, where you have, they're either like actively annoying, like for instance, or I think Short Round is probably one of the most notorious examples of a really irritating child.
I don't know what a Short Round is.
Temple of Doom.
Never watched it.
Oh, it's okay.
Too much plot.
I'm not a fan.
If you ask me.
Just too much going on.
Interesting.
Right?
Unrelated footnote. Temple of Doom is the first movie I saw with my dad on a date with someone who wasn't my mom post-divorce. So that was a strange movie-going experience.
We're hashing everything out tonight.
Absolutely.
Stick with us.
Goodness.
I'm a river to the podcast. All my emotions, all my experiences, all my insecurities. They're yours for the taking.
And we're talking about the children's episode. Why not bring up our children drivel?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, childhood trauma is totally fair game.
What?
But Short Round, did it ruin the movie for you? Have you
watched it? No, because I was that exact age when I saw it. I was 7 when I saw it, so I thought he was cool as shit. I was like, that kid's awesome. And then he showed me. I was the perfect target audience for Temple of Doom when it came out.
Okay. All right. So it didn't bother you. But I think, like, a child, you can either have, I feel like it's best if they're seen and not heard.
Although,
generally speaking,
Days of Heaven, voiceover narration by a child worked
really
well.
Southern Wild.
Great voiceover.
What I will say, though, I think it's a great powerhouse performance. She's not giving a performance. That's one of those things where they found this plucky little kid. She was still young enough to be considered cute, had a wild afro. Everyone loved her.
All right, well, what's y'all's favorite flick where the cast is predominantly children?
Oh, that's one of my favorite child performances is in The Spirit of the Beehive.
I've never seen
it. The little girl Anna. Oh, you have to see it. It's similar. The performance is similar to the Apu kid. Like, it's mostly in the eyes. It's mostly in the way she's framed, but she's adorable. And I just remember she's just captivating. And that's what I kind of mean by seen and not heard. Like, she's not necessarily communicating through dialogue. It's in.
I'm just picturing you like in 5 or 6 years with a couple of children and just telling all of them, children are to be seen, not heard.
Yes. Pretty much. That's generally my policy. But
did y'all ever see the original late 1970s Bad News Bears?
Ah, yes.
I feel like that's
another one I wanted to mention.
That's one
Tatum
of my
O'Neil
favorite with children.
Is,
no. Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon and A Bad News Bears, she hits an absolute home run, which is a perfect metaphor for a movie about baseball.
Billy Bob Thornton.
Yes.
Billy Bob Thornton, Linklater. How do you go wrong?
What?
The remake was made by Linklater.
I didn't see the remake. I grew up on the original.
That's blasphemous. That's blasphemous.
How's it blasphemy?
I
got to see a remake of a movie you like as a kid.
I can't talk to you. It got 50% of Rotten Tomatoes and you didn't watch it? That's a rough guesstimation. I don't know.
Is it not a beloved film?
No. I was just being an asshole.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Give me a second.
First one, what I love about it is that it is the type of movie that would never in a million years be made today. The kids cuss. They smoke. They are a rough bunch of little guys, but they are so adorable all at once. And I think that entire cast of kids, it was just solid gold.
I rewatched recently because
Jackie Earle Haley's still an actor.
You got
now.
Rorschach
working
in there
actor now.
As a child actor.
Yeah, a movie that I watched as like comfort food while I was in college for some reason repeatedly was Role Models, and it has that little black kid who's in it who hasn't really done much since. I think like a couple episodes of 30 Rock. How do you feel about like? I actually know exactly what your answer is going to be, but Lady P, I'm more curious on your end. How do you feel when children of that age are used for such I guess puerile or just like
a political end.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the idea that, oh, here's a cute little black kid that we could get to curse like savagely the entire film and make very easy black people jokes. And listen, it fucking gets me. I don't know why. I still think it's really funny, but there is certainly an exploitative streak to it.
I think just generally when it's like kids say the darndest things kind of vibe, it just feels kind of gross to me. Like children spewing hatred or just like being overly precocious is annoying. What I'm getting at is I don't like children.
That's an entire episode devoted to children.
I find very little of what they do charming.
That should be the subtitle for your episode on your website.
Yeah. So you're glad Apu was poor and having a rough time at it.
I have an 11 and adore kids, but I have a large family. I have four siblings aged 13 and under, and I absolutely love being around them. However, I don't want kids, so it's a kind of a weird thing. I love being around them, but I definitely enjoy coming home. So
okay, gotcha. Yeah, I guess what I look for in child performances, and this is so unrealistic, but I like underage adults, like wise beyond your years, like Jodie Foster and Taxi Driver being the quintessential example.
Or Dakota Fanning in anything she's ever done.
So you were talking about Jodie Foster and Taxi Driver. Does she qualify as a child performance? I feel like she is obviously very, very young, but she's also on the street working as a prostitute, that sort of thing.
She's still a child actor. I mean, she's 13.
I
think she's incredible. I love her performance in it.
Yeah, no, she's
great. Yeah.
And she's one of the rare cases where someone actually became a pretty damn good actress in spite of being hurled into the maw of show business at a relatively young age.
Well, I mean, like you see, so Kristen Stewart's another example, though. Yeah. She started off with Panic Room roughly around 11, and like now she's doing Clouds of Sils Maria, where she gives the best performance in the movie.
Mm. Any pearls of wisdom about directing a child actor in the 400 blows that you learned in your previous episode? See how I circled it back to you and your show?
Yes, the 400 blows, the Antoine Doinel series. I think the trick there is to cast your movie well. Speaking of child actors who grew up to be successful adult actors, Jean-Pierre Léaud.
Even in those audition tapes, which are on the collection, are incredible. He's already got a quality before they even give him any dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Francois Truffaut was in many ways very childlike in his approach to life. And I think he, and as a result, he was able to work with children really easily. And he did so in a number of different films, including The 400 Blows and also The Wild Child and a movie called Small Change. So there are some directors who are certainly just inclined to work with children and tell stories about children. And obviously, Francois Truffaut's childhood was somewhat traumatic. So it was a story that he kept revisiting. And like I said, you know, if you cast Jean-Pierre Léaud and where does this kid come from? How did he do that? How did he so fully embody this person at such a young age? It's really remarkable.
And grow to be a pretty damn good actor in his own right and do movie after movie after movie for, you know, decades to come.
Exactly, still working.
I guess
still
it helps if you grow up on Francois Truffaut film sets. I mean, you would get a pretty good filmmaking education.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And I think as he got older, he got more and more... Some say that he had more and more input into what was happening with his character.
Oh, I loved him in Day for Night. Day for Night or Le Nuit Américain. That's one of my all-time favorite flicks. For me, the perfect double bill of movies about making movies is Contempt in Day for Night. And but his character in Day for Night is my favorite character in the movie. He's incredible.
But other notable child performances, I did want to quickly throw out. Have you seen The Piano?
Yeah, I loved it.
Anna Paquin in that.
Yeah,
she's so wonderful.
She's fierce. It's like, where's your mother? In hell! she's astonishing.
And then not so much anymore.
She became a TV actress. So.
Yeah.
Which, actually, I shouldn't say that because now it's not an insult. It used to be an insult. Now it's a compliment. But
True Blood.
True Blood had one great season, then a season and a half. A slow, inevitable decline.
Very long decline.
She's a survivor, I would say.
She's a worker.
Actor.
She works.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
She was in Margaret, which was pretty much universally praised.
She was in 25th Hour, which I think was Spike Lee's last great film.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Squid the Whale. See, she's been in lots of stuff.
Yeah, totally forgot she was in that.
I'll ease up on her.
I like Anna Paquin.
That's it. We've all turned around on that back one.
Yeah. And I think one of the most notable child actors of the last 20 years, Haley Joel Osment. What do you guys think about him? He's making his glorious comeback, kind of.
I mean, Haley Joel Osment, I don't really think about him all that often. I mean, I saw him in Forrest Gump, saw him in Sixth Sense, saw him in AI, but I don't pine for the days where he was this wonderful child actor.
I mean, yeah, I don't. I wasn't like, oh man, I really. If only he performed more before he just kind of disappeared.
And in the '90s, when he was a phenomenon. It was a phenomenon that I was annoyed by.
Yeah. I liked him in AI, though, because I also think AI is a lot more interesting in a movie than people really give it credit for.
I completely agree.
That's just...
Well,
that's...
I think I smell a podcast. Anyway. All right. Well, real quick, should we list off... Did we already get all of our top picks out of the way?
Yeah, for me...
I got my entire emotional
Forbidden
baggage
Games,
out of the way.
Forbidden Games is the... It's the peak of the mountain when it comes to child performances.
Okay. And I guess I'm going to stick with Spirit of the Beehive. I like that one.
Alrighty.
Yeah. And you should definitely go see that movie. Check it out. Let's finish things off with a few positive notes. But before we do that, I want to address my cryptic hint about this segment at the top of the podcast. As we are recording this, it is still 2015. So well before its release date. And the reason for this is I'm going out of the country for a few weeks, so I'm stockpiling episodes before I take off, which means that potentially our final notes will be hopelessly out of date by the time this airs. However, to offset this problem, we're going to do predictions for what we will be into come early 2016. So, Mikhail, what's one movie, TV show, website, song, book, article, etc., that you will be digging in January?
Well, I guess in January I'll be excited that the Coen Brothers movie Hail Caesar is coming out in February. That is about it. I don't know what books are coming out around then. I don't know what TV shows are coming out around then, really.
Did you even like movies?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm coming to a wild conclusion right now.
That's the only thing that actually makes me live at peace with the aging process is that I usually have games, comics, movies, shows, and that sort of thing that I'm so enthusiastic about them coming out. I'm like, you know what? We can just skip a few months. I just want to get to that release date.
Well, no, because what I'm in this wild current right now, and we talk about this all the time, planning for the podcast and... just having my extra job and reading all the books that I read, it's tough to really kind of like plan and get excited for everything because I'm always just excited about the most immediately next thing. I was kind of expecting to be like, I'm culturally into this right now, so I have no
That
clue.
Works too. Do that. It's okay.
All right. Well, I'm currently reading the Steve Jobs biography by Walter Isaacson just because I did watch the movie and I've always been fascinated with Jobs as a person and just kind of a figure in the history of the world, really, and I wasn't too keen on the movie, and so I did want to, like, know more about his story and, like, flesh it out a little bit more in my mind and see what the movie could have possibly been if David Fincher was on it and a better script might have been on it. I'm sorry, Jamie, but that's how I feel.
I totally agree it would have been a better movie with David Fincher, but even without him...
We got the movie that we got.
Yeah, I know.
It's no point even arguing it, but the book is endlessly fascinating. It's a page-turner, and... he's a wildly interesting character. The one thing that I wish they did try to go for...
And the son of a Syrian immigrant. So for everyone arguing against immigration, there might be a future Steve Jobs coming our way.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. We're talking about topical things right now, too.
This is not going to go over as well in January, hopefully, because we'll have world peace by then.
But
that is Mikhail's answer to what he's excited for in 2016.
That came out two years ago.
Fair enough. All right, Jamie, do you have a prediction for next January?
I've got a lot of stuff I'm excited about across various forms of media, but big one would be Dark Souls 3, which is a console and computer game. Dark Souls 1 and 2 are two of my all-time favorite games, and Dark Souls 3, I will disappear for a month when that fucker comes out. I'm going to descend into the world. They're notoriously extremely difficult, but incredible dungeon design and just fascinating lore. It's just their game's as good as they get. So I'm very fired up for that. On the really geeky side of things, Captain America Civil War has given me a nerd boner with a capital O. I really, really like the Russo brothers, and I like watching people punch each other and wearing costumes, and that's going to be a good one.
Yeah. All right. Okay. I like it. When does that come out?
That comes out in May. And okay. The big interesting conflict is going to be who prevails in the Warner Brothers versus Disney battle, because you got Batman versus Superman coming out about 6 weeks prior. And so, of course, everybody's already getting entrenched. You got your Marvel zombies on one side and your DC guys on the other. And like,
and then our you have Mikhail somewhere in the middle.
But yeah. I mean, comic book fans tend to get very childish. I just hope for good movies. And if they're both great, then we all win. So.
All right. I like it. I like it. Mine is Patrick McGilligan released a new biography on Orson Welles that focuses on his life pre-Citizen Kane. So his childhood up through Citizen Kane.
Well, Simon Callow already covered that really well in The Road to Xanadu. That's going to be a tough one to beat.
We'll see. But I predict I will be very excited about young Orson, because by the time this airs, I will have read the book. Right now, I'm just planning on reading the book. But I've endorsed Patrick McGilligan in the past for his wonderful biography on Fritz Lang. And just given his exhaustive research and his writing style, I have no doubt that this will be a fascinating read. So that is what I am looking forward to. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what do you think are some of the best child performances? Come let us know in the comment section on our website, flickswise.com. And if you want to yell at us for leaving off one of your favorites, come have a temper tantrum on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And we promise to make it all better if you follow us on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But if it's approval you seek, make sure to smile big for mommy and rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. Okay, that was really creepy.
I thought it was very melodious.
Okay. I felt like I was writing this and I was like, that is creepy. What is wrong with you?
The mother thing?
Read it like a creepy child actor.
Creepy? Okay. Sure.
Yeah, just like you got a huge lollipop in your hand.
Yeah. Make sure to smile big for mommy and rate us. And leave us a comment on iTunes. It is so creepy. What a creepy thing to write.
Especially if Jamie's considered the mommy in this scenario.
I'm an excellent mommy. How dare you?
So on our next podcast, we'll welcome back to the show Professor James Naramore for a discussion about Roberto Rossellini's Journey to Italy. So you don't want to miss that.
That's a damn good one. That's a good one.
I know, right? George Sanders? Yeah.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary movie.
In the meantime, guys, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find all of our stuff at wrongreel.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at wrongreel, or you can follow me at Colbrex.
And you can follow me for when I'm on there at the Karadimov on Twitter.
All right. Well, so is there anything people should know about Wrongreel?
That is the greatest podcast of all time.
Of all time.
All time.
All time.
Which podcast have only been around like 10 years, so it's not saying much. But.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the first podcast I've ever been traveled through a black hole. I've heard. I don't know. That's what people are telling me.
Also, if I were to pitch it to people who haven't heard it, Wrong Reel, we cover all kinds of movies, whether it's the trash put out by Canon Films or the most sublime poetic cinema of Ingmar Bergman. So if you're a person who likes all cinema, trashy cinema, great cinema, middle of the road, whatever
you... Or the plotless drivel of Yuzhit Rai.
Yeah, or like, you know, early silent movies to the most recent stuff, but we cover large, small, foreign, domestic, doesn't matter, so it's any and all films of any kind. So yeah. That's Wrong Reel. And we do it in the most profane way possible.
All right, well, so cool. That is awesome. People can check you out at wrongreel.com. All right, so thank you guys for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting us.
Real soon. All right, well, so until we meet again, take care, everyone.